Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis, but today I am without my co-host, Ben Pronk. But don't worry. You'll get plenty of opportunity to hear Ben in this episode. It's a reciprocal where Andrew Lee, who you'll remember from The Tale of Two Andrews that we interviewed alongside Andrew Hasty, well, Andrew Lee interviews Ben. Now, this interview was done a little while ago in which Ben tells his story. Ben talks about growing up and entering the military, doing SAS selection, and why SAS selection is important. Of course, he talks SAS leadership, fitness and his complete absence of coordination, and why fitness, while it's important, is not particularly critical in the SAS. There's, of course, a good slice of coalition operations and a bit of business. And when you get to the end, don't hang up. Listen through the end, because I'm going to add a little bit of bonus Ben with a twist. Let's get on with the show.
What we want our special ops to do, and our SAS in particular, is to be able to tackle those missions without precedent, to be able to come up with novel solutions to problems that we haven't thought about before.
My name's Andrew Lee, and welcome to The Good Life, a politics-free podcast about living a happy, healthy and ethical life. In this podcast, we seek out wise men and women who have lessons to teach us about living life to the full, with humour, pleasure, meaning and love. We'll chat with musicians and athletes, CEOs and carers, about making the most of this one precious life. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to tell your friends or rate us on Apple Podcasts. Now, sit back and enjoy the conversation. Ben Pronk is a soldier's soldier. At the Australian Defence Force Academy, he was the Academy Cadet Captain. He gained entry into the elite Special Air Services Regiment, a unit of 700 soldiers based in Perth. After 9/11, he served on multiple deployments and was decorated for leadership in action. He finished his career as commanding officer in the SAS and recently retired after 24 years in the Army. Ben's now managing partner at Metal Global Holdings, a consultancy focused on risk and crisis leadership. Ben, thanks so much for joining us in the Good Life podcast today.
My pleasure, Andrew.
So, did you always want to be a soldier growing up?
I think I did. My father was an army officer. He flew helicopters, and not through any sort of coercion from him, but I'd just seen what was on offer as a military officer, how much he'd enjoyed his career, and I think a bit of that boy's own adventure style of things. He'd tell us wonderful stories about flying survey missions in Papua New Guinea and in the northwest of Australia, and so those kind of life less ordinary options that seemed to be available through the military were pretty attractive.
So what does a high schooler who wants to have a great career in the military do to prepare themselves?
Probably not what I did. I sort of, academically I was okay and relatively driven on the academic side, but certainly not the sporting sort of guy. In fact, I still get a lot of static from my friends about my complete lack of sporting prowess. So I think...
Is that because you didn't try or because you just went for a good?
Yeah, I was... I'd like to say it's because I didn't try. I think it's more because I wasn't very good. And also, I don't think the bug hadn't bitten me. And so it took me a while sort of after leaving school to really get into. And I think, like yourself, I got into distance running as a bit of a first step. And, you know, again, probably exactly like yourself, once you get that bug and you find the satisfaction and the personal development you can gain from that, that was definitely a stepping stone in that direction. So to answer your original question, I think some level of physical activity would probably be a good thing. And look, the academic side of things is super important. I think it's getting less so, but certainly in my father's day and age, there was a bit of a perception that if you couldn't get a proper job, you could always join the army. And so I think that, you know, there was a bit of a stigma in some cases about being in the army as it pertained to sort of intelligence and flexibility of thought, which certainly in my experience is almost the polar opposite these days.
So you went to ADFA straight out of high school?
No, I took a year off. I was graduated from high school relatively young up in Queensland and wouldn't have been of drinking age by the time I hit ADFA. That sounds really bad, doesn't it, that was the deciding factor? But I think for a bunch of reasons. My father and I actually, I took a gap year, although they weren't calling it that back then, and we did a lot of travel around Australia, which was just this incredible formative experience and wonderful time with Dad. And
just the two of you?
Yeah. So we did a bunch of different trips. I guess the culmination of it was actually supporting an army adventure training exercise that was walking across the Great Sandy Desert with camels. Mm. We're in the support crew and we'd meet them every sort of 6 days and do this incredible driving and sort of resupply this camel train, and just an amazing adventure and a really special time.
Had your dad retired by this stage? How did he have the time to do such wonderful stuff with you?
He had just retired, and in fact, it's a funny, not a dissimilar career arc. He'd got to the point, we're living in Toowoomba in southeast Queensland at the time. I just finished high school. My brother had a couple of years left, and they were about to post the family back to Canberra, and it was that real sort of family or job decision point for him. And so he'd just retired at that point. So it was a nice little bookend, I guess, to his military career and to my school years.
Has it made you think you want to do the same thing with your kids at that age?
Without a doubt. Yeah, it was very... I mean, my father passed last year, and so, you know, I guess I'm getting sort of sentimental looking back on it, but it was a very special time. And, you know, all these sort of transition from boyhood to manhood type thing, you know, it was a very formative year, and I'm very glad I'd done that prior to joining the army. I think at that point I'd been sort of a schoolboy, and then having that year, I think I was in a much better position to go into the army and into the Defence Force Academy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've talked to other interviewees about the way in which they, as parents, try to create something which is in a way akin to the old tribal rituals that marked that transition from boyhood to manhood, and just highlighting the fact that we as society don't do this particularly well. Mm. So what were your impressions of ADFA when you got there?
Look, I loved it, and I still am an enormous advocate of ADFA as an institution. It gets periodically bad press for a whole bunch of different things, but particularly in our day, it was tri-service, you know, everyone was mixed together, both genders, three services, the 3 year levels were all put together into a divisional structure. And so it was a wonderful networking, if nothing else, opportunity. Mm. And when you look at sort of like militaries across the world, not many of them do that. And certainly as I progressed through my career, I reckon it was a first decade, I couldn't get on a Navy vessel or an aircraft without knowing someone on board, which was just fantastic. And that structurally, institutionally, I think was very positive. But it was really good fun. You know, good hard training, obviously the academic side of things, and that great, you know, I think we'll probably come back to talk about initiation rituals or sort of tribal type concepts, but it was certainly that any form of shared hardship can really bring people together, and you develop those closenesses that last throughout life.
You said you weren't that sporty at school. Did you find that initial training at ADFA pretty tough?
I'd had a bit of a sort of metamorphosis in that year off. I'd recognised that, you know, things have just got real. I'm about to join the army, and I probably needed to be in better shape, and so had quit my nascent smoking habit and started running, and to the point where I found myself actually as one of the fitter individuals at ADFA. So the fitness was pretty good. My coordination to this day remains pretty embarrassing, and unfortunately I think I've passed that on to my kids as well at some point. My wife's extremely sporty. She sort of played basketball for the state and stuff, and she despairs at some of my genes coming out in our children.
So how do you become the Academy Cadet Captain, which is, you know, why I guess the sort of the equivalent of the head prefect of ADFA?
Exactly, as my wife says, the hall monitor. Look, it was a combination of what they called officer qualities and your academic results. And so, look, it was by being a bit of a goody two-shoes. Again, I look back and wonder if I shouldn't have enjoyed some of the more traditional university pursuits a bit more. But look, I was very focused at that point, and I guess to an extent have remained that way throughout my life, but was really wanted to achieve in both the military and the academic side of things. And so, I did sort of buckle down and sort of pursue those goals.
At what stage did you then go on to apply for the SAS?
Yeah. It was a funny journey. I'd always had that as this, I guess, pedestal sort of idea. Mm. But I remember coming home from, I think, first year ADFA and saying to my dad, who was obviously spent his career in the military, I said, "Look, Dad, what's this SAS stuff all about? And, you know, what do you think about that?" And he said, "Mate, you don't want to do that." He said, "That these SAS guys, they're nutcases." He said, "You know, as you'll be going out to drink a beer on a Friday night, they'll be walking around with rocks in their pack, and, you know, it's the wrong sort of thing." And actually, you know, life imitating art. About 5 years later, I distinctly remember in Laverack Barracks in Townsville, where I was training for selection on a Friday night, my mates driving past on their way out onto a pub, throwing beer cans at me, calling me a moron. And I thought, "Yep, Dad, you were right." But no, Dad's view was always very much, you know, you've got two choices. You can either carry your house around on your back, or you can fly home to a five-star hotel. And he obviously chose the latter. But I'd always had a bit of an inkling. And then in our third year, the adjutant at the academy, who's actually now the special operations commander, as the head prefect, the head hall monitor, I had a relatively close relationship with him. And so he was an ex-SAS guy and got a lot more understanding of it there, which really sowed the seeds.
So as I understand it, there's two screens. There's an initial sort of physical and interview screen that takes out about a third of people, and then there's the three-week selection course that takes out about two-thirds of those who start in it.
Yep.
The first sounds fairly straightforward, but that 21-day course, what's it like? What do people do? Because you've not only done it, you've run it.
That's right, and it's really interesting seeing both sides of it when you're on it, particularly the first time, and particularly relatively naive as I was. I think people these days are a lot more sophisticated towards, you know, what the process is designed to test and prepare themselves better. But when you're on it, you just seem to think things are coming at you in a very random and sort of barbaric order. But obviously, there's a lot more structure behind it. Look, as a candidate, It is what it says on the tin. You know, it is designed to test your ability to continue functioning in very arduous, ambiguous circumstances. And it's very interesting for me, looking back both as a candidate and as directing staff running it. Very little of it is actually about physicality. I mean, there is a base level of physicality which is required for the job. Certainly the most arduous military thing I've ever done was in Afghanistan and not on the selection course,
right,
you know, so it
right.
gets harder. And it does need to prove a base level. You need a certain level of fitness.
Keep it concrete for us, Ben. What sort of things are people being asked to do?
So it is heavy. So food and sleep deprivation is a base. So on a number of these activities within that
How
selection
much food?
Course.
How much sleep?
Sort of none. A couple hours sleep a night, no food, sort of for about a 5-day period, give or take, you know. So really designed to simulate, you know, to get you to a relatively low ebb. And it does a couple of things.
First, so zero calories for 5 days?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, I tell a lie. There is traditionally one meal in it designed to be as unappetizing as possible. It might be some form of genitalia and jelly or something like this, again, designed to sort of put you in a circumstance where, you know, you need to prioritise caloric intake, and so you'll eat things that are unappealing.
Yeah.
But by and large, no food and a couple of hours sleep sort of periodically throughout a 24-hour period, yeah. And it really serves the function of just stripping you down to who you are as an individual. I mean, you get a lot of people who can put on a show or some kind of facade and sort of get through certain aspects of it, but it's very hard to keep that up when you're at that level. So that's one thing it does. And the second thing it does...
What are people doing?
Oh, we call it DS watching, directing staff watching. So they're performing spectacularly when the assessors are around and they're saying all the right things and they're doing all the right things or pushing heavily on the trailer but not actually exerting any effort. These kind of things, those kind of like I said, facades get very difficult to maintain over time. When you're completely exhausted, and so you see the real person, which is quite insightful in a number of cases. The other thing is you really see that mental drive, that ability to keep going, keep putting one foot in front of the other towards a goal when it seems hopeless or completely ambiguous. And in actual fact, that's what we're screening for. And in my opinion, if we could conduct that same screen without so much emphasis on the physical as the vector to do it, we'd have a really powerful tool, because there are a lot of people. We've recently opened selection up to both genders. I think we lose a lot of good people of both genders on the physical side of things that could otherwise be employed for that mental drive and that mental ability to keep continuing, functioning, thinking relatively clearly in those arduous situations, just because they haven't got that physicality. So I think we're constantly looking at ways of sort of finding those characteristics, but so far the physical one is the most powerful and most really cogent way that we found.
So you mentioned the task before of pushing a trailer. What other sorts of tasks are making comprising the days over this 3-week period?
Again, that's the difference between the participant, the candidate, and the staff. As a candidate, you think it's just pure bastardisation. It is these patently impossible tasks. Carry these extremely heavy, awkward objects, down this ravine up to the other side. You sort of do that. 12 hours later, you finally get to the other side. And then they'll say, no, you've got the wrong parts. You need to take them back and replace them. Another one we had, which was in hindsight hilarious, we had to carry these chickens, live chickens, in our pack. That was our food, and it was a scenario. And we were led by this guide who was supposed to be an Indigenous leader, and he told us all that chickens are revered in his culture, and if you cause the chickens pain, then you will have to do physical punishment, sort of thing. And of course, these chickens are squawking. We're carrying stretchers in our packs, and the chickens are squawking. Every time the chickens squawked, we'd be doing burpees. And I remember, I think most of us got it, that this was just designed to be something difficult and, almost that stoic approach where, you accept that you can't stop the chickens squawking. You just need to deal with what's in your power to control. And yet I vividly remember one person he couldn't get it out of his head. If he could just stop the chickens squawking, then it'd all be rosy. And he was sort of in tears saying, look, stop banging the chicken. He sort of missed the point of what was in his own control. So it was things like that. And again, there'd always be the scenario would dictate that you needed to have someone on security. And then all of a sudden they'd say, now this person's injured, so you need to carry his pack, just to add the weights on top of it. And I remember at the time just thinking, this is just pure bastardization. They're just, trying to get people to drop out. But very amusingly, sort of 3 years later in Afghanistan, we had a situation, 5-man patrol on the border with Pakistan, did a night insertion, night resupply, so carrying very heavy packs, 60-odd kilos worth of kit. And as we stepped off from the resupply, our signaller rolled his ankle and couldn't walk, couldn't get the helicopter back in. And so we had to help him carry his pack, have people out looking for bags. It was like this bastardised selection stand, except for real. And I remember at that point very clearly thinking there's method behind the madness in terms of what they're assessing for.
And the dropout process, is that do people get told that they're out, or do they? Is it mostly just self-selection out, where people put their hand up and say, I can't take any more?
Yeah, mostly self-selection. There's a few formal gates. There's a couple of physical tests, and there's a couple of periods where we will formally have gates. And if people just aren't displaying the characteristics that are required, then they'll be told they're off. However, it's the vast majority of it is people WOR, withdraw on own request. And in fact, I remember you get issued a slip. You've got to sign this slip to say, I want to withdraw. And it's a bit formalised. It's not the Navy SEALs in Coronado in the US. They have a bell. You know, it's quite a famous thing. They ring the bell and they're out. You know, it's not quite as formalised as that. But you have to actually go through a process. And I remember as soon as I got the slip, I tore it up and sort of discreetly burnt it at one stage. So I figured that might act as an insulation. You know, I'd have to go through the embarrassment of asking for a slip before
like
I could sign
it. Like the reverse of burning a draft card. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. I'm here to stay.
And so in some sense, you're selecting for pain threshold, but also, as you say, those sort of stoic qualities as well. Did you feel that you gained something from that selection process?
Without a doubt.
Okay.
And I'd be interested, because I never have heard of anyone saying that they didn't learn about themselves throughout that. Again, it's that shared hardship, so you become very close with the people you've done selection with, but that pushing yourself beyond limits, all those sort of cliches, it really does go to show what you as an individual are capable of.
Yes.
And I think it's a very strong platform to then face challenges further down the line. There are few things, I'm certainly nowhere near as fit as I was back then, but there are a few physical challenges that I don't think I could, you know, face and overcome as a result of having gone through that process. And of course, that's exactly what they're trying to do, such that when you're in Afghanistan with a guy with a rolled ankle, you've got to walk however many kilometres to an extraction point carrying his pack, you know you can do it. It's going to hurt, but you know that it's feasible.
So then you're in training, and the training is famously tough. I understand the SAS has lost more people in training than in combat. Everyone has to learn to jump out of a plane, for example. How does your typical day look at training?
So this was, you know, if I look back professionally, certainly, it's the most amazing period. So you've trained for selection. It's this crucible moment. You go through it all. You have this awful anticipation right at the very end where they say, okay, the course is over and you don't know if you're selected, and then all of a sudden you're in and you're just amazingly elated. And then from there, there's a very distinct switch in focus. So at that selection point, essentially you're trying to weed out, you know, you're trying to select the people you like, but you're trying to, I guess, get rid of people who don't display those attributes. After that point, it's within the organisation, the military's best interest, to get you to the end state. So you're really trying to keep the people you've got. They've demonstrated that they've got the trainability. And bear in mind, the selection course is all about searching for someone who is trainable.
Right.
And so we very famously have people from non-infantry backgrounds, you know, F-18 pilots who do extremely well historically, submariners, these sort of characters who have sometimes never really put a pack on their back before the training process. We're looking for the ability to train them in the skills, not the fact that they have those skills coming in the door. And so the next phase is giving them that suite of skills. And I spoke about Boys Own Adventure. I mean, this is over a year worth of these incredible parachuting courses and diving courses and driving cars fast and blowing things up and all sorts of weapons. It's just an amazing period of doing, I guess, things that are at the acme of the military profession, really exciting, interesting course.
And then there's a great deal of flexibility too in terms of the weapons that SAS officers are allowed to take into combat, their ability to modify weapons. People have beards or are allowed to, you know, grow their hair the way they want to. Why is there that sort of almost the flowering of individuality within the SAS? What's the thing behind that?
Look, I think, I mean, certainly on the weapons side of things, there's probably not as much flexibility as maybe perceived externally. There's still obviously issued weapons, and there's a lot of clever reasons why you can only use things that have gone through that quality control process. So, but your point is very valid. There is more autonomy within that range of approved equipment. What I think at the core of the answer to that question is the concept that in many cases what we want our special ops to do, and our SAS in particular, is to be able to tackle those missions without precedent, to be able to come up with novel solutions to problems that we haven't thought about before. And so we're very much trying to develop that autonomy and that lateral thinking and all those sort of characteristics within the regiment. And so that removal of some of those, I guess, more traditional military sort of hierarchical boundaries is part of that. And, I mean, bear in mind, it works because we have done that thorough screening process. We are looking for people who are generally more mature. They don't need those imposed sort of disciplines and sort of rank relationships. They can respect that an individual is in charge and that, you know, we can have a spirited debate about the way to go ahead. But once that decision's made, we'll get on with it. These kind of things, which don't necessarily translate into, you know, a larger army structure. So that ability to I guess come up with new ideas, to think under pressure and to come up with novel solutions is at the heart of the more relaxed and greater levels of autonomy for members of the unit.
So what sort of those agile problems did you strike on deployment? I understand there's limitations as to what you're able to talk about, but are you able to give us some broad examples of sort of complex challenges in the field?
Yeah, I think certainly I was involved in a number of shipboarding operations as a troop commander. You know, the MV Tampa was one of those. And I think that was a really good example of, you know, using a force, a military force, mainly because the problem presented was beyond the capabilities of, you know, the civil powers. So the police didn't have the reach to get out, or the vehicles, or the deployment time, or the boats, et cetera, et cetera. And so this was a situation where we were able to adapt a suite of military skills. So we were well trained in sort of boarding hostile vessels and taking down you know, terrorist forces on a ship. We're able to adapt that into a very sensitive political situation and achieve an outcome. Now, all sorts of debate about, you know, whether we should have gone or whatever, you know, at that point ours is not the reason why. But we were very clear on, you know, the political ramifications of this, and that if we went in with a sledgehammer and sort of an overt or a more militaristic approach, that could have negative consequences in the long run. And so that ability to use that military tool in what's essentially a sort of political capacity is the kind of thing I'm talking about.
I should remind the listener that this is a no politics, no policy podcast.
In case people
wonder why I'm not pursuing all of the political context that that sits around the Tampa. But, you know, what's interesting about that, I guess, Ben, is that just preceded 9/11, and then post 9/11, the SAS becomes very much an active tool of Australian foreign policy. How did you find your first deployments to the Middle East?
I mean, the word that was right in the tip of my tongue when you asked that question was exhilarating. I mean, a lot is made of, rightly so, of, you know, the horrors of war. And by no means through this response am I saying that war is anything other than generally a miserable experience for everyone involved. However, there is still some kind of, I guess, professional satisfaction in terms of being used for what you've trained for, and so that sort of level of excitement, I guess, is a fairly common reaction across the board for people deploying for the first time, and being able to use, I guess, put into practice the training that you've spent in some cases a lifetime leading towards. But also at that stage, we went in very early after 9/11. There was still a very clear, in my mind, link between, you know, the transnational terrorism, the sort of AQ training camps that had spawned 9/11, and what we were doing in Afghanistan. And so I think there was a very clear requirement down at the military level. Obviously, as things evolved, I think that probably became more and more opaque. But, at the time it was I think a sort of justified mission and as I said, professionally, quite an exciting one.
And you would have been working quite closely with the UK SAS and American Special Forces. What marks the Australian SAS out from the regiment and the Green Berets?
We certainly That is quite correct. We have worked very, very closely with those organisations since that time, and I'm extremely proud to say that I consider our soldiers of equal calibre in terms of an individual level. What I think you just can't replicate is the kind of scale of particularly the US approach to special operations, and so all the sort of enablers, the technical enablers, the equipment, the assets, the manpower that really drive, you know, the special operations. We sort of don't have that same sort of scale. We've certainly got the capability at an individual level, but not the all of the machinations behind it. So I think there's some level of commonality, and I reckon there's probably a PhD in there somewhere that people who go through these processes, you tend to get a similar sort of person, and there's that shared bond, even though you haven't been through the same course, you share a sort of same sort of tribe. And so, yeah, we had very fond and close relationships. And like I said, pound for pound, I think certainly a comparable level with our British and American counterparts.
What do each of those forces do better than us? I mean, you talked about the American sort of access to equipment in particular.
Yeah.
What is it that you look to the British to inform the Australian SAS on?
I think in many cases, the big differences are how their governments choose to use the military. Obviously, US foreign policy has a very different slant on the use of military force, and I think the British still, you know, from the days of empire, still view their military as a probably a more active tool of foreign policy than Australia would. And so it was interesting to compare and contrast the kind of approaches that the US and UK militaries were getting directed to take. And so, yeah, that was quite instructive. As I mentioned before, I think particularly the US, their integration of intelligence and developing, you know, particularly in the height of sort of Iraq, that kind of period, developing target packs from multiple sources of information and different sort of means, was very mature and very sophisticated. The kind of stuff that Stanley McChrystal talks about in his Team of Teams book, that kind of multidisciplinary integration, I think is something we learnt a lot from. And to tell you the truth, I think has a lot of applications. I mean, there's a reason why that book's a bestseller in sort of business fields as well. It's got a lot of applications outside of the purely military or national security arenas.
Yes, indeed. A bit like Sun Tzu sort of being perennially updated for business audiences.
Yeah.
How do you think about your leadership style in the field? I know one of your soldiers, Andrew Hastie, says that the enduring story he has about you is that rather than leading from the back when the bullets were flying, you were somebody who people would look over to and see you right next to them. What is it about that you think about your leadership in action?
I think one of the big things within the unit, I mean, one of the very interesting things about military leadership is you're often in a position where you're the leader, but you are the least experienced person in that organisation, particularly at the junior levels. If you think of a platoon commander, so a young, maybe 19, 20-year-old individual, straight out of Duntroon, you might have had 18 months of training, and then all of a sudden you're in charge of 30 Australian soldiers, some of whom have had, you know, a full career. The platoon sergeant will have had a full career in the military. And so instantly that makes a very interesting dynamic where you need to be able to leverage off the skills and capabilities of the people below you, and you need to be very reliant on them. But you also need to have some ability to back your own decisions and to have the confidence to get up in front of those people and say, we're going to charge that machine gun nest and follow me. And so that kind of dynamic is, I think, a really good sort of formative one. And certainly within the regiment, as you come in as a young troop commander, you, again, are the least experienced person. Main difference is that in the regiment, people will remind you of that fact. But, again, the machine works very well. They recognise that you bring different skills and characteristics to the dynamic, and that it's their role as much as anything to help you along to make the right decisions for the organisation. So I was always very acutely aware of that and very much sought to use the expertise within the organisation. And I think looking back, the greatest challenge that I would find is making that decision. You know, when do you sort of use the advice and when do you trust your own instinct? And that's constantly a sort of judgment battle going through.
How important was being physically fit to this? Others have talked about you as being pretty hardcore, as a triathlete and CrossFit, and that being important in terms of somebody in their late 30s, early 40s garnering the respect of a more junior soldier in their 20s.
I've got some pretty strong views on the importance of that. So to answer your question, yes, I think that is really important. I think two things as an army officer: if you can, you know, demonstrate a level of physical fitness and look the part, and if you can string two words together in front of a group of people with some level of confidence, that can cover up for a lot of ineptitudes. And in my case, has very much covered up for a lot of ineptitudes. On reflecting about that, I do a little bit of work with the AGSM, teaching a leadership subject there. And I talk about this theatre of leadership, and it's not to say that you need to be fake or pretend you're someone you're not, but it is to say that there is an element of perspective in leadership. And so while not everyone's going to be that sort of 6 foot follow me men type character of a leader, you do at times, particularly in high pressure times, need to be someone that people can look to with some level of confidence that you know how to get the organisation out of that problem. And so a lot of those, I guess, sort of physical based cues, you know, that you look the part and that you can speak confidently, can greatly assist in that regard.
How did you find the interpersonal challenges? Because a lot of your work isn't firing guns; it's having endless cups of chai tea with village elders, right? That must have been a massive shift from a lot of how your basic training is setting you up.
It, to an extent, however. And this is another one of those, I think, misperceptions about life in the military. I think, and certainly had reflected back to me, that a lot of people think, oh, it must be so easy in the military. You just give an order and it happens. In many cases, and particularly in a unit like the SAS, where you've got really smart, you know, proactive, lateral thinking subordinates, it's it's definitely not a directive sort of environment. You know, you need to be working with people and understanding different perspectives, working out what the, you know, incentive mechanisms in any given structure are to try and progress an objective. And so much of that is translatable, not only in that the military context you just described, but also, I think, in a wider business environment. I think we're pretty well prepared for that, and particularly I spoke about that team of teams thing before. When you are working with interagency partners and diplomats and police and Indigenous partners and all that sort of stuff, you very quickly become attuned to working with a whole bunch of different stakeholders with different agendas and trying to balance those in terms of achieving what you need to.
Did you enjoy the tea drinking side of Afghanistan?
Very much. Yeah, it was a fascinating insight. I increasingly, as I get older, believe that if I've got a black and white opinion on any subject, it's a real warning sign that I don't know enough about it. Mm. And so you go into these environments where, and I think
who knows only his own case knows little of that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we tend to demonise our enemies, and the media is very good at trying to make a reductionist, polarized worldview. So you go in, and of course the Taliban are all bad. You know, these can't. They must be some other. You know, a different kind of sort of evil person. And then you get to understand the tribal overlays, the dynamics in there, and it very quickly becomes shades of grey. And I think one of the most, I guess, telling sort of situations. One of the soldiers sort of reflected that if we'd grown up in, you know, Uruzgan province instead of Perth, you know, we'd probably be fighting for the Taliban. You know, it's just the kind of path that they were on and did. And so many of these people weren't the sort of stereotypical enemy character that they were made out to be. So very complicated. And getting an understanding of that and, I guess, a more nuanced appreciation for all the dynamics that were going on in that theatre, I thought was a real honour that we were able to be in that position to really sort of start to look at some of the grassroots problems.
And I guess because you were in there early on, you saw that sort of arc of counterinsurgency and the sort of the insights of people like McChrystal and David Kilcullen in pointing out that an overly aggressive approach simply creates more and more adversaries.
Without a doubt. And I think, I mean, Iraq's probably an even more acute example of that. That, you know, these are, well, in both those cases, I think they were viewed as military problems, but of course they weren't. You know, they were governance issues. There was a whole law and order factor. There was industry, employment, all of these sort of problems, you know, root cause problems that the military tool can't solve. You get into, again, this is a reductionist view, but the only tool you've got is a hammer, all you see is nails. You know, without the ability to have your you know, your State Departments or you know, in our case obviously DFAT or DFID in the UK example, right alongside from that early point to try and rebuild the infrastructure that the wider society is going to need, then you just perpetuate this military problem and you have the second order effects that we saw.
Now, you're a big fan of having multiple skills, and you had this quote from Robert Heinlein's science fiction novel Time Enough for Love in a recent presentation, which goes as follows. A human being should be able to change a diaper, plan an invasion, butcher a hog, con a ship, design a building, write a sonnet, balance accounts, build a wall, set a bone, comfort the dying, take orders, give orders, cooperate, act alone, solve equations, analyse a new problem, pitch manure, program a computer, cook a tasty meal, fight efficiently, die gallantly. Specialisation is for insects. It's about the most anti-economics quote I can ever imagine, given that my discipline is one that lauds specialisation. What do you like about it?
I came across that quote through CrossFit, actually. So Greg Glassman, who started CrossFit, I think used that specialisation is for insects bite as a bit of a justification for the physical approach they were taking, that, you know, you want to, whatever he says, outlift a runner, outrun a lifter type thing. And then I think that's a wonderful sort of synopsis of what it means to be a human being and what we should aspire to. And certainly from my perspective, I spoke about this team of teams concept, and we were just talking about the you know, military tool trying to do other things. I like that idea of having the exposure to a whole bunch of different ideas and even just a base level understanding of the different requirements of a wide spectrum of vocations. I think it makes you a richer human being, but I also think it makes you fundamentally better at your job. And in fact, Charlie Munger, the Warren Buffett's right-hand man at Berkshire Hathaway, talks about having a latticework of models, which is a very similar sort of concept. He talks about getting these big ideas from big disciplines. So you understand a bit of psychology and you understand a bit of medicine, a bit of economics and a bit of what the military does and a bit of what how government works. And that kind of lattice work gives you a much richer worldview, and it provides a better and more sophisticated lens through which to look at a problem. It sort of guards against that, you know, the only tool I've got is a hammer, you know, maybe this isn't a military problem, maybe this is a, you know, primary care medical problem or something. So I like that idea. And look, I love the sort of Renaissance man, Renaissance person concept. I mean, none of these individuals were one-trick ponies. You've got the poster boy Leonardo da Vinci sort of painting and sculpting and inventing and drawing and coding and, you know, all sorts of things. Yeah, which, you know, even from my please do not think I'm comparing myself to Da Vinci or even putting myself up as a Renaissance individual, but having pursuits outside of your primary vocation, I think, is a very healthy thing.
So you're in this interesting position, being in your mid-40s and now having finished a career. What are the other lattices, to use Charlie Munger's term, sure, that you're looking to acquire over coming decades?
Look, I am very much enjoying the business aspect of what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm extremely relieved, because it probably means we can keep paying the mortgage, but I'm extremely relieved that a lot of the military skills are very transferable, and I think we are offering, through our consultancy, different ways of looking at things, maybe another different layer in the lattice work to a lot of businesses. So that's good. But one of the things that I'd never done in any great depth is sort of that business, the hard-nosed sort of profit-loss statements type work, and this is a wonderful new challenge as part of this new business. Look, I've also, over the last, 5 years, really got into painting as well, which, again, is that sort of something outside of that primary occupation, and have been really enjoying that and want to keep pursuing that throughout the remainder of my years. So, yeah, those kind of things. I think always having that next challenge is pretty healthy.
Did you get to know Ben Quilty when he was over in Afghanistan?
I didn't, okay. No. In fact, his cousin, Andy Quilty, is an artist out of Rockingham who I've had quite a bit to do with. He worked as part of a military arts program, so he's donated very generously his time, taught a number of classes, and I got to know him through that. And just a spectacular guy, real champion, yeah.
Ben, what advice would you give to your teenage self?
Look, I would tell myself to lighten up a little bit. I think I was very serious as a teenager, and I mentioned before at ADFA, my probably one regret is not pursuing some of the traditional university pursuits as much as I should have. But I would certainly seek to a bit earlier. I sort of explained a bit earlier the idea of benchmarking, you know, small little accomplishments as stepping stones towards other things. I would have started that process a little earlier. So the physical side of things, I, as we mentioned before, I would have done that a bit earlier. But yeah, I really think that idea of exploring a whole bunch of different things and not being so concerned about, you know, just getting the good grades. I think we tend to put a lot of pressure, and I think it's increasing on kids that, you know, you've got to do well at year 12. I mean, my brother's a great example, who just never really sort of got into a groove at high school, and, you know, everyone thought, oh, he's going to drop out. And anyway, he sort of subsequently became a doctor and ended up in the military as well, and, you know, done these amazing things from there. And, you know, it was just a timing thing for him. And I think there's so much pressure that you need to have it squared away by, you know, age 16, 17. I think I'd suggest lighten up a bit. There's a whole bunch of stuff after the teenage years where you can still choose your path.
What's something you used to believe but no longer do?
I have drifted away from formalised religion. I was christened and baptised and all that sort of stuff as a kid. And I do still have faith. I know that always sounds like a cop-out, but I do think there is a concept of goodness that is bigger than just the day-to-day transactions on a purely sort of existential level. But the more I've seen, and I guess my military experience has played a big role in this, the concept of formalised religion I increasingly struggle with.
Did that shift come post-deployment? I mean, there's the old cliche, there's no atheists in foxholes.
Yeah, and I think that probably speaks to this idea of faith and idea of a goodness, you know, that. And I think just, I mean, my father was a great example. He was not a religious person, certainly not in a practicing sense, but he was the most, I guess, small-c Christian person I knew. I mean, he never drove past someone broken down on the road, and he'd, you know, he'd pick up rubbish, and he'd, you know, if he found a wallet, he'd go to pains to return it with all his money. You know, these kind of what I guess is codified in any of the major religions, you know, the Ten Commandments type behaviour, but without the, I guess, the institution around it. So that was certainly an influence. And but yeah, I do think you know, in this current IS, ISIS type situation, where you're just seeing this awful, you know, the most barbaric human manifestations of power, you know, just these awful acts being conducted in God's name. I mean, I find that a sort of disturbing perversion of what are pretty noble institutions. And so for me, it makes sense to practice being a good human being outside of a religious construct.
When are you most happy?
Well, this is going to sound like a cliche, but my family is just this amazing achievement. And it took me a while. I mean, this is probably one thing I would tell my teenage self, that I think we get filled with this idea that, you know, relationships are love at first sight across a crowded room and happily ever after. And it baffles me still. I can't reconcile this, but, you know, we spend all this time and effort professionally developing ourselves and getting degrees and courses and blah, blah, blah. And yet we think our relationships, the most important part of things, should just come by osmosis or naturally or something. And so this idea that the family side of things, my relationship with my wife, my kids, you know, it's this constant, it's just messy, you know, there's things going everywhere, and it's not like it is in the romantic comedies and that sort of stuff. But it's just so wonderful, you know. And so just those little vignettes that you have, you know, we're walking down the beach yesterday, and just little snapshots like that aren't ends in themselves, but when you reflect, they're the things that I think make you happy. And you know, a big part of this career change for me has been looking at, well, what is my definition of success or happiness? Mm. What do I want to be when I grow up? And I think I'd always just thought, well, it means that next rung on the ladder or a bigger paycheck or, you know, the next rank and status and all that sort of stuff. And I think probably happiness is probably closer to those little vignettes. And if you can string as many of those together as you can, you're probably doing all right.
What's the most important thing you do to stay mentally and physically healthy?
Without a doubt, some level of physical activity. And this is, we've just finished building a house, and we built a little gym at the back of our garage. And so my wife and I will train there in the morning. And that is just a wonderful time that we spend together. Mm. And, you know, it's a great, obviously, the physical side of things. I think that is crucial, some level of physical exercise. I think it just enriches life in sort of a whole bunch of different ways.
Do you do weights or cardio?
Mainly weights. I need to get back into cardio. In fact, I want to get back into running. I mean, you're a distance runner.
Yeah, marathon runner.
Yeah. So I'd done a number of marathons way back when, and loved that. I think the romance of it, you know, the loneliness of a long distance runner, all that sort of stuff. And I'd love to get back into that, and I think will at some point. But yeah, for the time being, we do sort of weights and CrossFit-y style stuff in the gym. Yeah.
Do you have any guilty pleasures?
Yeah, I do. I've got terrible taste. Well, yeah, terrible taste in both music and movies. So I mentioned rom-coms before. You know, I've watched the occasional rom-com and sort of don't mind them. And in fact, I do remember. So my playlist on my iPhone is embarrassing. And I remember accidentally, we were on deployment up in Timor at one stage, and we had this combined sort of bush gym. And so there were these enormous commandos in there and a bunch of guys from my troop. And there was no music, and so I plugged my iPod in, not thinking, and you know, play. The first couple of songs were, you know, respectable gym song, workout songs. And then I can't remember if it was Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera or, you know, a real clanger came, and it just stopped the whole gym. And foolishly, I sort of went over to rectify it, but of course, in the process, it, you know, owned up to it being my playlist. I didn't sort of quite live that down. So, yeah, I reckon pop music is probably pretty high on the list of guilty pleasures.
And finally, Ben, which person or experience has most shaped your view of living an ethical life?
I think my father. I mentioned before, it was quite... It was actually really surprising. So he died of lung cancer last year, and had smoked two packs a day for 50 years. So that's going to kind of catch up to you. And he'd been diagnosed about a year prior, but as it turned out, the end game came quite quickly. And so all throughout that year, he had been amazingly philosophical, and in hindsight had made his passing so much easier on us by choosing to reflect on, you know, he'd say, you only ever promised 80 and, you know, I got an extra 2 years on that. And he'd talk about how proud he was of us. And so he really filled that last year with very positive reflections. Mm. The end game, as I said, was very quick. I bolted over from Perth to Sunshine Coast where he was, got in at midnight. The hospital sort of called us at 5 a.m. and we bolted in, and he passed within about 8 minutes of us arriving. So it was, you know, this amazing sort of, I think he was hanging on. He wasn't conscious. Anyway, we then had the funeral very shortly after that, and it was this amazingly cathartic and uplifting experience. People came from everywhere, and Dad, he had a good military career, but he was never chief of army or any of that sort of stuff. He'd always provided for us, but we were never rich. So those metrics, he hadn't, you know, sort of risen to the top of industry or made $1 million. But people that didn't have to come to this funeral came and shared reflections on him as a good human being. And it sort of validated what my brother and I had always thought, that, you know, he was one of the good guys. And as I mentioned before, not traditionally sort of, you know, religious or any of those sort of things, but that concept of goodness that I spoke about before, I mean, he was probably up there in terms of being an ethical individual. And yeah, I definitely try and replicate those kind of characteristics.
Well, Ben Pronk, soldier, athlete and leader, thank you very much for taking the time to share your insights on the Good Life podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Tim Curtis again. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Andrew Lee and Ben. I promised some bonus, Ben, and in true SAS style, I'm going to beg forgiveness. This particular audio isn't mine to give, but I think it's significant, and before I play it, I'd like to describe a little bit of what you're going to hear. It's actually a video that we can't show. It's a video taken on operations in the Middle East and recorded in a bee hut with Ben and two other guys playing acoustic guitar to a small collection of heavily bearded and dishevelled SAS operators. The bee hut is simple. There is nothing on the wall except for a whiteboard and a television. Now, this song is significant as it's recorded on the anniversary of the death of the lead singer of this particular band. He sadly died with two colleagues. Enjoy the show. Living.
Richard Burton, dance like John Travolta.
Now.
Daniel saving grace, oh, he was all for drowning. Now they live like dolphins. Getting away with it all messed up. Getting away with it all messed up. That's a living. Getting away with it all messed up. Getting away with it all messed up. That's a living.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.
Get around them.